Is it better to take the high road or the low road? They're both sad, but for one road, the person is dead, and for the other, the person is grieved or bereaved. Which is which depends on the interpretation of the song you prefer. Let me start by warning you that the history behind this innocuous-sounding song is right in my wheelhouse or up my alley or whatever expression you want to use. I'll try to rein myself in, but it's going to be hard. So hang in there with me to find out more than you ever thought possible about a song you've probably heard many times but never questioned. Let me just quote the chorus before we get started. Oh, you take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye. But me and me true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. The person who takes the low road is going to get to Scotland first, but won't ever see his or her true love again. So who's speaking and what's going on? The most common explanation of the song is that it refers to the Battle of Culloden in 1746, which was fought in Scotland between the forces of the British Crown and those who saw Charles Stuart as the legitimate heir to the throne. Let's see now, where to begin. In order to get even a glancing idea of how this all started, I have to go back to Henry VIII, that bloated, monstrous figure who had broken with the Roman Catholic Church in the 1530s over his desire to divorce his first wife and marry Anne Boleyn. For the 200-plus years since then, England had swayed back and forth between the Roman Catholic Church and the Church of England, or Anglican Church, a conflict that was for many in government simply a matter of politics and power, not true religious belief. Since Elizabeth I, Henry's third child, had died unmarried and childless in 1603, the throne had passed to her cousin James Stuart, then the King of Scotland, and he had become James I of England, as well as James VI of Scotland. His son, Charles I, ended up getting himself beheaded during the English Civil War, and Charles's sons, Charles and James, went into exile. Eventually, Charles Jr. was invited back to rule as Charles II, an event in 1660 that is called the Restoration. Well, everyone heaved a sigh of relief. The new Charles was quite content to rule as an Anglican and devoted himself to his own enjoyment, earning the nickname the Merry Monarch. The number of his mistresses was legendary, but alas, regardless of how many illegitimate children he may have fathered, he had no legitimate heirs. So on his death, the throne passed to his brother, who became James II. Here's where things got even more complicated, and here's where we start on the immediate chain of events that leads to our bi-level road. While Charles II had been pretty comme-ci, comme-ça about the whole religion question, James very much leaned Catholic. Everyone hoped, though, that he'd die without any male heirs. He was in his 50s when he became king, and his first marriage had produced only, horrors, two daughters, Mary and Anne, who had been raised Anglican. His second marriage to the Roman Catholic Marie of Modena produced 10, yes, 10 pregnancies and 5 living children, but all of them died young. So, again, sighs of relief all around, even over miscarriages, stillbirths, and infant deaths. Then, in 1688, 3 years after James became king, and 5 years after Marie's most recent pregnancy before this, a son was born who seemed capable of surviving, who would be first in line for succession since he was a male and who would definitely be raised Catholic. There were deep suspicions that this baby had been smuggled into the royal birthing chamber by way of a warming pan, thus that famous phrase, warming pan baby. You haven't heard it before? That did it. The British just couldn't stand the thought of yet more civil and religious strife and a return to Roman Catholic dominance. So they deposed James and invited the Protestant William of Orange, husband of Mary from James's previous marriage, remember her, to come take the throne. This event, called the Glorious Revolution by those who welcomed it, forced James with his wife and son into exile. When James died in 1701, this son, Charles, claimed the British throne, for all the good that did him. He mounted some unsuccessful invasions, but they never got anywhere. Fun fact, he was called the Old Pretender by those who denied his claims to the throne. A pretender to the throne is exactly what you'd think from the wording. The old illegitimate claimant is a bit of a mouthful. And why is he the old pretender? Because he had a son who also claimed the throne. He was called the Young Pretender. But this son's most famous nickname was Bonnie Prince Charlie. So now, after many stops along the way, we've finally gotten to the point of our song. By 1702, William and Mary had both died and had no living heirs, so Mary's sister Anne succeeded to the throne. Her 17 pregnancies produced miscarriages, stillbirths, and infant deaths, with only one child surviving past boyhood, and he died at age 11. Anne's husband was Danish and also Lutheran, so he wasn't in line for the throne. You had to be a member of the Church of England to sit on the British throne and also to be in the royal line in some way. George of Denmark wasn't too bright of a bulb anyway and seems to have had no royal ambitions. So when Anne died in 1714, the Catholic Stuarts were of course ignored, and the throne passed to her nearest Protestant willing to be Anglican relative, her second cousin, George of Hanover in Germany, who became George I. But there were many supporters of James Stuart and his descendants who believed them to be the rightful heirs. Finally, after a number of failed attempts to retake the throne, the Jacobite forces, Jacob equals James, under Bonnie Prince Charlie, were soundly and decisively defeated in the Battle of Culloden in 1746, a battle that lasted only an hour, but had far-reaching effects, especially on the losers. BPC fled back to France and lived out the rest of his life in exile, mainly known for his mistress collecting, thus following in the footsteps of his great uncle Charles II. The apple, as they say, doesn't fall very far from the tree. But the Scottish ringleaders who had fought on his behalf were either killed on the battlefield or captured and taken back to London for a series of show trials, at the end of which at least some of them were found guilty and executed in, as one source puts it, the vilest way possible, which would have been by the method of hanging, drawing, and quartering. A gruesome, protracted means of death used for maximum pain and humiliation that included partial suffocation by hanging, then cutting open the belly and removing the intestines, then, sometimes, cutting the body into quarters, or, more commonly, beheading it. We have records showing that the main rebel lords were simply beheaded, which was at least a quicker death. TMI, perhaps? Anyway, the heads of the executed men would then have been put on pikes and paraded back along the highway, so the High Road, to Edinburgh, capital of Scotland, serving as an object lesson to anyone else who would have been contemplating the continuation of the Jacobite cause. The families of the condemned men, including wives and girlfriends, would have come to London to view the trials and executions, traveling by the low road, that is, the paths and roads that were available to them as they walked down to London. They would have returned the same way, getting back home sooner than the heads and corpses of their loved ones, since they wouldn't have been stopping along the way to be displayed. So the idea of a wife or girlfriend speaking in the song fits pretty well. She will never see her beloved again where they used to meet on the shores of Loch Lomond, the largest lake in Scotland. The Bonny Banks of Loch Lomond is an alternative title for the song. There's a shift in the object of the lines, though. At first, the sweetheart is speaking to her lover, and then, as she shifts to me and me true love, to perhaps the crowd at the gallows? I've pictured her at the foot of the platform where all of this horribleness is taking place. I will say, by the way, as a little aside, that the execution scene at the end of the movie Braveheart is pretty realistic, and the movie as a whole portrays an earlier attempt by Scotland to gain their freedom. Mel Gibson, whatever his various falls from grace since then may have been, is fantastic in it. The above is the most commonly accepted interpretation for the lyrics, and it's probably the best. There is evidence that many prisoners were either exchanged, banished, or simply set free, but there were almost certainly some whose heads were indeed carried back on the high road. This interpretation calls for the song to be performed by a woman, but it's often sung by a man. There is at least one other possible meaning that would fit a male. The idea, well attested in the historical record, that prisoners to be executed were chosen by lot. A single man, perhaps someone with no dependents, could have taken the place of a married man with children. Then we'd have to say that the low road is the grave, or perhaps the traditional underground route used by fairies or little people who were said to return any Scot dying in a foreign land back home to rest in peace. The speaker is now the doomed man, speaking to his friend whose place he is taking, and he knows he will never see his own true love again. There's even a version of the story that specifically has the two men be two brothers and gives their names, but I found this version in only one source. Since the executed man's spirit can be instantly transported, he'll get back to Scotland before his friend. So the high road is simply the regular road that the freed man will take. I guess that interpretation makes sense, but it leaves out the whole heads on pikes parade, which removes some of the gruesome local color. I think I'm going to stick with Fiona of the flaming red hair crouching at the foot of the gallows for my interpretation. And then I talk about the videos that I'm including. Here's a wonderful, beautiful, evocative video by a performer whom I'd never heard of, but who is clearly someone to be reckoned with since she's garnered over 4.5 million views. I especially like the way the older version of the sweetheart is incorporated into the video. It's great. And if you'd like to hear a brief, only 5 minutes talk about the song, which I think does somewhat overstate how many Scots were actually executed, here's the link, The Dark Tale of Bonny Loch Lomond. And again, this link is on the written version of this post. And here's at least one version of the lyrics with the caveat that I try to include with all folk songs that there are many variations. By yon bonny banks and by yon bonny braes, where the sun shines bright on Loch Lomond, where me and me true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. Oh, you take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye. But me and me true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. 'Twas there that we parted, in yon shady glen, on the steep, steep side of Ben Lomond, where in soft purple hue the highland hills we view, and the moon coming out in the gloamin'. The wee birdies sing, and the wild flowers spring, and in sunshine the waters are sleeping. But the broken-hearted kens nae second spring again, though the woeful may cease from their grieving. Oh, you take the high road, and I'll take the low road, and I'll be in Scotland afore ye. But me and my true love will never meet again on the bonny, bonny banks of Loch Lomond. And I do have a footnote I'm going to read aloud here. The contemporary composer and arranger Phyllis White, in a personal email to me about another Scottish song, wrote this: I would share that on this sabbatical, I stepped onto the battlefield of Culloden Moor. It was surreal and eerie, nearly 10 degrees colder, with grass that grows ghostly on bonny green graves.